This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We appreciate you joining us here on Trumpet Hour. We are ready to discuss the events of this past week with our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from an undisclosed location here stateside in the United States, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
So, once again, Britain has shocked the world with a surprise election result. Not even 2 months ago, British Prime Minister Theresa May called for snap elections in order to try to strengthen her position within the parliament to have as much leverage as possible in negotiating the complicated Brexit process. And polls predicted that she was going to win in a landslide, especially considering the radical views of the Labour Party, the main opposition party. And it was thought there was no chance that British voters would allow these people anywhere near power. But yesterday, British voters proved they're more radical than people gave them credit for. For this story, we're going to go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
That's right. It's just a shocking result. Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party won 40% of the vote. That's their best result, I think, since Tony Blair won in a landslide in the early 2000s in terms of percent of the vote. Now, they didn't win enough to govern. Theresa May, it looks like she's in the process of putting together a government with the support of the Democratic Unionist Party, a conservative or a right-wing party from Northern Ireland. So it looks like she's going to remain prime minister, at least if no one in the Conservative Party decapitates her. She's going to remain prime minister and have this very tiny majority, really, with the support of the DUP and have a kind of a tenuous hold on power. And you know, you can see this being quite an unstable government. Then you've got the fact that the Labour Party just did so astonishingly well. In the run-up to the election, you know, the Labour Party themselves were trying to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. Most of the big names in the Labour Party, the politicians who've been around for a long time, refused to serve with him because they tried to bring him down. They thought that just he was absolutely unelectable. And now all of a sudden he's proved that wrong. He didn't win, but he did well enough that he's proven that actually these kind of extreme positions that he put forward have a widespread mass appeal.
So how much does this handicap Theresa May, and how much does this affect the Brexit negotiations going forward?
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see to a certain extent, but I imagine it'd be very, very difficult. You know, it would only take a handful of MPs out of the 300 or so that support her to derail any piece of law that they don't like, any say relationship with the European Union that they don't like. So when it comes to negotiating her way out to the EU, she's in a very tough position now, because if she tries to draw or go for, say, a soft Brexit at this point and make a lot of concessions to Europe, well, all it would take would be half a dozen Conservative MPs that are staunch Eurosceptics, and they could cause major headaches for her. But if she goes for a quote-unquote hard Brexit, exactly the same problem. It would just take, again, a handful of pro-European Conservative MPs, and there are plenty of those, and again, she's in trouble. So to be able to steer this through, you know, just negotiating with the European Union alone was going to be tough. To steer this through now Parliament with almost zero wiggle room, and then with opposition in the House of Lords, because the Conservatives do not have a majority in the House of Lords, it's not going to be a fun job for her. I would not at all like to be in her shoes now, trying to negotiate with the European Union.
So there has to be some schadenfreude on the part of European politicians who see this. Like, she was deliberately did this in order to have a stronger negotiating position and to increase the wiggle room, as you describe it, in being able to pass whatever legislation would be required to deal with Europe in a, from a more advantageous position. And exactly the opposite has happened here. She's actually operating from a weaker position now than she had to begin with.
Yes, that's right. And I say there's a split response. You look at the real Europhile, hardcore people in Europe, then yes, they're the ones that kind of have the schadenfreude, and that they're kind of, you know, gloating a little about this. But then some of those ones that did actually kind of more seriously want to get on and have a productive negotiation and have some kind of relationship with Britain are, they seem, you know, almost frustrated, because they know that it's going to make just their job all the more frustrating as negotiators, but the ones actually doing it, because they could spend all this time putting together some kind of deal only to see Parliament reject it. It's going to make their, so, you know, just from a practical point of view, it's probably going to make their life harder. Not the less the fact that at this point they're not entirely certain who they're going to be negotiating with.
Right.
Like I said, it does look almost certain that Theresa May is going to continue as prime minister and that we'll have a conservative government. But even that is still not settled right now. So, you know, there's been talks of the Brexit negotiations being put off and delayed yet again. Meanwhile, this 2-year clock is ticking. I think Theresa May doesn't want them to be put off. So we'll just have to see how things go over the weekend. But it in some ways makes their life pretty hard.
So let's talk now about Jeremy Corbyn and the Labour Party that has emerged within Britain. This is obviously, it's the party of Tony Blair. It's been a mainstream party. And now this mainstream British political party has come to embrace openly Marxist ideas.
That's right. It's a party. To me, two things stand out from Jeremy Corbyn and his leaders and the ones around him. Firstly, is just this hatred of the West. He led the Stop the War coalition. While he was leader of the Stop the War coalition, the group wrote that Britain and the United States were no less sociopathic than the Islamic State. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how they view their own country. Diane Abbott, who is one of his insiders and, you know, was in line for a senior government position, she said that Britons invented racism. They, you know, all of them, like Jeremy Corbyn, he's palled around with PLO terrorists, Hamas terrorists, Hezbollah terrorists, accepted money from the Iranian regime to appear on their television show, been friends with IRA terrorists, even somehow the M16 terrorist group over from Colombia when they were back in the 80s, taking people hostage and blowing people up. You know, there's this deep-seated hatred of the West, his refusal to sing the national anthem. He tried to get rid of the Queen through an act of Parliament. You know, there's that aspect of it that is deeply, deeply worrying. And then there's the Marxist, very communist aspect of their program. So John McDonnell, who would be in charge of the economy under a Jeremy Corbyn government, he has said, "I'm honest with people, I'm a Marxist." He's also said on national TV, "I'm not a Marxist," so I think the "I'm honest with people" statement there is up for debate. But he said, "I'm a Marxist." He said, "I don't just want to bring down the government. I want to smash the system." You know, typical Marxist rhetoric that. He said, you know, we need insurrection. We need to bring down this government by any means we can. He said that a few years ago in the wake of the financial crisis. He basically welcomed the financial crisis as an opportunity to try and smash the system. And their manifesto just calls for a massive, unprecedented expansion of the government. You know, the government would take over the railways. They'd take over running the power stations and the electricity grid and the electricity distribution, take over the water system, the mail system. So a massive government takeover there. $35 billion spending on infrastructure, $6 billion more for the National Health Service, $5 billion more for schools. Taxes ramped up everywhere, especially on businesses, massive increase in corporation tax. And then even these tax increases wouldn't come close to funding this. So you're looking at tens of billions of extra spending. The chief economist at the Institute of Economic Affairs think tank said, "This is a whole new order of magnitude. It's the kind of spending that you would only expect during an existential crisis like a war." He said they're going to get involved in almost every aspect of life. It's like they're trying to reverse all the post-war liberalizations in one go. It's unprecedented. So Britain is already in debt and has been increasing debt, and their program is just all about massive government involvement in the economy, fueled by massively more debt.
They didn't take power, but 40% of the voters giving them the nod, it really is extraordinary. It just makes me think of Herbert Armstrong talking about the fact that the sun sets on Britain earlier than it does on the United States. And Britain, in so many ways, socially and here politically, has gone down militarily. They've gone down faster than the United States. But you look at the political picture in the United States, yes, in this last election, Bernie Sanders wasn't even able to win the Democratic Party nomination. And yet, obviously, the Democratic Party has appropriated a lot of his ideals, and it's become far more radical in recent years, and particularly just in the last few. But kind of taking on that legacy of Barack Obama, it's becoming more openly radical. But up until very recently, it has had to mitigate, or it's had to soften its rhetoric, at least to some degree. Here in Britain, they're not really softening their rhetoric much at all. They're embracing these very radical positions. And if Britons wanted to repudiate that and put a stop to that the way that so many people expected them to, yesterday would have been the opportunity. And yet they said, well, this is a future that we're comfortable with.
That's right. And as you said, yeah, these guys, I think, are more, I mean, Jeremy Corbyn is more maybe Hugo Chavez than Bernie Sanders. They really are out and out extreme. And just in the live TV coverage this morning, I already saw one of the kind of leading moderate Labour MPs, the type of person that was leading the resistance against Jeremy Corbyn, actually embracing him and his program now and saying, well, oh, actually, you know, whatever Jeremy Corbyn's got, we all need to be drinking it. We all need to get on board now with this. And so I think you're starting to see these moderate now MPs, the type of person that, say, in the Democratic Party would be against Bernie Sanders and trying to not take things to quite that extreme. They're saying, well, actually, this isn't the election loser that we thought.
Right.
We need to get right behind this guy. And so I think it will be really interesting now to see after the election just how this perhaps could build momentum. I mean, before the election, people took it for granted that you know, it was just talk on whether Jeremy Corbyn could survive.
Right.
Now, are you going to see more and more people just embracing this and moving dramatically to the left? And of course, the Conservative Party moved to the left as well during this election. And so you're seeing this major shift in British politics, even though they didn't you know, come out in top place.
Absolutely stunning election result. We appreciate you bringing that to us. Richard's actually working on an article that we will put on the website, I believe today, at least in some form. You can watch for that. He has one up there already, a UK election chaos, what next? The other one is something to the effect of, these are the communists that just about took over the British government. So go ahead and go onto thetrumpet.com and read that analysis. We appreciate that, Richard. This past Monday, a political earthquake shook the Sunni world in the Middle East. Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, and Egypt all severed relations with Qatar, and several other nations followed suit soon after. Trumpet writer Callum Wood says the fracturing of these relations could reshape the region. And to learn why this happened and why it's important, we're going to turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it's easy to look at these events from anywhere else in the world and not think that they're too significant, particularly because Qatar is such a small country. But it is the wealthiest country in the world per capita. It's got a lot of oil money. Doha is the capital. Many people fly through there. And what we're seeing over the past 5 or 6 days is its regional neighbors, part of the Gulf Cooperation Council members, cutting off Qatar because of their relationship both with Iran and other terrorist entities such as Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood. So back on Monday, it was kind of out of the blue, it seemed. But at first you had... well, as you mentioned, those three nations that were right next door, the largest being Saudi Arabia, saying we're stopping our relationship with you. But it wasn't even diplomatic ties. It's It's now economic. Any type of business transaction between Qatar and these other states has been canceled. Travel to these states has been canceled as well. If you're a Saudi national, you've got 2 weeks to get out of Qatar. If you're a Qatari national, you've got 2 weeks to get out of Saudi Arabia. Qatar gets 40% of its food through its only land border with Saudi Arabia. That's all been halted. The borders have been closed. Any ship with a Qatari flag can't dock in any of its neighbor ports. So this is an extremely serious rift that's developed between Qatar and its longtime Sunni allies.
So what are the Saudis after here? Why did they do this?
Well, I think for a long time now, and it's not just been in the last 2 weeks or the last week, we have seen Qatar go after its own independent foreign policy position, breaking from the GCC in a number of areas, especially with its relationship with Iran. They are much more open to trade with Iran. Even the Iranian foreign minister came out a couple of weeks ago when he was meeting with the Qatari foreign minister and said that they wanted to increase trade between the nations. And then you also have Qatar's funding and housing of Muslim Brotherhood leadership, and their Muslim Brotherhood's like one of the biggest, obviously, Islamist networks in the world, if not the biggest. And some of their leadership right now lives in Qatar. Hamas's leadership, also political leadership, has lived in Qatar as well. And I think it came to a point where the Saudis are kind of fed up. In conjunction with the United States, I might add, this coming after Mr. Donald Trump's visit, Mr. Donald Trump had a tweet basically praising the Saudis or the GCC for this decision to try and strong arm Qatar, a largely Sunni state, from siding with their enemy, siding with Iran and other terrorist proxies that Iran does business with.
So it's essentially aimed at limiting Iran's influence.
For sure. And limiting Iran's influence, and with Qatar being a member of the GCC, it dilutes the power of that body, because you always have a nation or similar to Oman in a way that is willing to not give general consensus to that group and not make its resolutions as powerful or as serious. And this is all coming, of course, as you say, in direct defiance or direct retaliation for Qatar's relationship with Iran.
So in a sense, it also is kind of ceding that territory to Iran and acknowledging a certain amount of Iranian dominion over Qatar, in a sense. But it does seem like it's drawing those lines. It's drawing the line between these two entities within the Middle East, this Iranian-centered axis and this Saudi Arabian alliance, all the more strongly.
For sure. That's something that Callum Wood writes in his piece, and he draws attention to that. Go back a couple of years, and even especially before the Yemen civil war began, before the Houthis took over that, and you had the borders, or the sectarian borders throughout the Middle East weren't that strong. And even, I shouldn't even say sectarian borders, because Qatar is a Sunni state, and yet it is, you know, in a relationship with Iran and the GCC as well. But what we've seen over the last couple of years, as Iran has tried to use its relationship with these countries to be more ambitious with its regional goals, Saudi Arabia has said, no, we need to put a stop on this. And so that's why right now they're trying to say to Qatar, your time is up. Are you with us or are you with them? And we have seen the Iranians that have said, we're willing to support Qatar in this, that they're willing to send a lot of food over to Qatar to supply them. They've increased flights to Qatar from Tehran and other Iranian airports so that people can still get in and out of Qatar, because all flights to Qatar or out of Qatar to any of the GCC states have been canceled. So you've got to try and find a different way to get in there or leave. And Iran has said that we're willing to step up and help. Qatar right now, 5 days on, they're not budging. They said that they will not negotiate. These ideas that Saudi Arabia wants, that they rebuff Hamas and the Muslim Brotherhood, don't look like they're going to happen, although there have been some Hamas officials that have left the country in the past week. So we'll see what more pressure. I think Saudi Arabia does have a lot of leverage over Qatar, but Qatar is extremely rich and it can hold out for a while if it so chooses.
We appreciate that, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. We're going to go now to Asia. China has been aggressively moving into the strategic waters of the South China Sea in recent years. It's a story we've been following closely. Trumpet writer Jeremiah Jacques has just written an article saying this is a done deal. South China Sea now belongs to Beijing. To learn why, we'll turn to Jeremiah.
Yeah, I think if we think back to around July of 2016, it really looked at that time like conflict could break out between China and possibly the United States and or some of the smaller Asian nations in the region, just over China's very aggressive drive to dominate the entire South China Sea. But now here we are about a year on from there, and I think that we can say without having had to wage a war, China has essentially won and now has de facto control over this vast, very resource-rich, and strategically valuable area. There's an analyst named Mira Rapp-Hooper. She's with the Center for a New American Security. She recently said that in the South China Sea, quote, "it is unfortunately now game over." So China has won, and that really reveals a lot about, first, the United States' fading power and China's rising power, and also the smaller Asian nations, just how well aware they are of this shifting power balance and just that they're very pragmatic about sort of trying to realign themselves accordingly. And a lot of this centers on the fact that China has waged a really relentless campaign to build artificial islands in the South China Sea, and then they've militarized those islands. And there was very little meaningful pushback from the U.S. or from any other involved party for this behavior. But then last July, there was an international court at The Hague that ruled against China's claims and said, these are illegitimate claims. You know, these islands don't give you sovereignty over the waters that surround them the way a natural island would that you owned. So this should have been a huge blow to China. It should have been a huge victory for the Philippines and the United States. And it was at that time that many analysts said things really look like they're primed for conflict because China feels like it's backed into a corner now. But then
Just thinking about the Hague, like who is it that actually enforces the power of a decision like that by the Hague? You know, an international body is really only as strong as the members that comprise it. And in this case, you know, it really comes down to who's actually willing to challenge China.
That's exactly right. And at that time, just after that court made that ruling, the United States under President Obama made the decision not to reinforce that court judgment by conducting a freedom of navigation operation in the area. The U.S. did conduct some innocent passage actions, but those mean very little. If he had conducted a freedom of navigation operation, I think it would have shown the Philippines and the other claimants and China that, hey, this court ruling, it is an international court, but the U.S. is backing it up. Mm-hmm. But he declined to do that. And so the leadership in the Philippines quickly realized that without U.S. backing, that court ruling meant basically nothing.
Right.
And so Manila decided to not even acknowledge their victory. And then the other Asian nations in the region sort of followed the Philippines' lead. And that was just very telling, I think, about how those nations view China. And so then in May of 2017, President Trump did conduct a true freedom of navigation operation near one of China's islands. But at this point, it's really too little too late. Those islands are rapidly being militarized. It's a little bit belated to think that we could check this aggressive behavior at this point. And then once you factor in the North Korean angle, you see that Trump's hands are really tied. He needs China to help him apply pressure on the North
right
now. And so he really wouldn't be able to do much to tackle China's aggression because the more pressing threat, at least from his vantage point right now, is North Korea. And so when you put all this together, it just really looks like China essentially has won that battle.
You contrast President Trump's approach toward China now with the one that he was taking while he was on the campaign trail. He was much more aggressive and belligerent about the way that he would talk about China, the way he was going to deal with China. But he's backed down considerably. You mentioned the North Korea threat, but really just that one bit of leverage and the way that China has used that, you can see how much of a difference that makes in an arena like the one in the South China Sea. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Again, you're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Venezuela is a disaster right now. Living standards are plummeting. Food shortages are common. Inflation is in the triple digits. A lot of poverty and violent crime there. And the government is becoming more authoritarian. It's crushing the opposition. It's killing people who are protesting against it. Almost 70 people have been killed in massive protests in the last 2 months. Part of the reason for what's happening here is the support that the government of President Nicolas Maduro is receiving from Cuba. This is the country that the Obama administration reopened ties with recently between the United States and Cuba. To learn more about this, we're going to turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, there's definitely some rumors going around Washington, D.C. right now that President Trump is considering reversing some of the travel openings and economic openings that were part of his deal with Cuba. President Trump mentioned in his campaign that he'd be open to that. There's rumors going around about it right now. The National Interest published an article talking about that. That looks like that may be likely. But so far, 5 months now into the Trump presidency, the Barack Obama deal with Cuba has not been changed, which is interesting, because that deal was really predicated on the notion that Cuba is no longer a state sponsor of terrorism, mm-hmm. as in the Obama CIA said they hadn't supported any terrorism for the 6 months prior to the deal, therefore it's probably okay. Now, however, as you mentioned, that they have thousands of Cuban officials supporting what many would consider terrorism in Venezuela. As you mentioned, with the country's economic meltdown, the people are almost to the point of uprising and civil war against their government. And President Nicolas Maduro, he knows that his only chance of keeping power is he needs the military on his side. Although now you're almost to the point where it looks like the military may split, with a certain amount going to backing the people, a certain amount backing the government. To stop that from happening, he's brought in at least 12 high-ranking officers from Cuba and thousands of intelligence officials, basically to spy on his own military. Mm-hmm. And that way, if there's anyone that looks like they're sympathizing with the protesters, they're arrested. I think, to my knowledge, there's been at least 85 Venezuelan officers arrested so far on sympathies of being disloyal to the president. And I don't know, a lot of them may have been informed on by Cuban officials, which just does show how closely communist Cuba and socialist Venezuela are in on this.
Not exactly the kind of characters that the United States really wants to be consorting with, you would think.
No, and it's actually because even President Obama, shortly before he left office, declared Venezuela as a potential national security threat. And the CIA, the current CIA director, has mentioned that there's just really this thought that if the country does descend into civil war, that a lot of these very high-tech weapons that Venezuela has bought from the Russians could end up falling into the hands of drug cartels or terrorist groups or other things that would traffic them into the United States. So this is a security threat to the United States, just the fact that you have a failed state just a few hundred miles south of you. And just really condemning for the fact that we're now, a lot of people say that we've had these sanctions on Cuba for decades, hoping that when Castro finally died, hopefully we'd have enough economic pressure that they could foster some regime change in Cuba. And they said that President Obama's policy really kind of just blew a hole in any of those hopes by giving all this economic support, shoring up Cuba's communist regimes within a year of Castro actually dying. So we made it through like a half a century to the finish line,
right?
And then gave up 12 months before you would have had your chance for an opening in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
Now, even if President Trump reverses that, I mean, there's been a lot of money flown into Cuba. The communist regime's much more in a stable footing there than it was now, enough to where they can actually provide money and support to Venezuela. So, I mean, in a way, you could think that the United States is actually kind of funding Nicolas Maduro's crackdown on his protesters in a roundabout way. We don't give them money direct, but we give to the Cubans who turn around and pass it on.
It's an extraordinary situation, and I you know exactly how this fits into the bigger picture of what's happening. I think you do have to at least consider the role of the Vatican in both of these countries, Cuba and Venezuela, because there's a certain amount of it's certainly sought inroads into Cuba, and the opposition to Maduro seems like they're more closely aligned with the Vatican. The Vatican has given a certain amount of support to the opposition within Venezuela, and I'm sure that they're watching that situation very closely, and exactly how that all plays out, definitely something that we need to watch. We appreciate that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about a terrorist attack on the world's number one state sponsor of terror, a new home for the German Air Force in the Middle East, two members of a massive Asian alliance being added, and how the world is sitting on a $400 trillion financial time bomb. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
The world's number one state sponsor of terror is Iran. Well, this past Wednesday, its capital city was stunned by brazen attacks on its parliament building and on the tomb of Ayatollah Khomeini. Usually Iran is the one underwriting these kinds of attacks, not being the victim. To learn who was behind this and to put it in context for us, we're going to turn back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, it was a brazen attack that was surprisingly effective, and one, though we've talked about Iran's role in terrorism quite well, and that's very well documented. That all happens outside of the nation's borders, obviously. And yet the Islamic State on Wednesday, they have claimed credit for this attack, really struck at the heart of the Islamic Revolution, targeting, as you said, the tomb or the mausoleum of its founder, Khomeini, and then also striking at the parliament. There were 17 people that were killed. I don't think there were any actual parliamentarians that were killed in it. But this was a surprisingly effective attack. It seemed that the Iranian military, intelligence ministry, they came out and said that these were Iranians that left to fight for the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, and then they returned back into the nation last year, and they've been planning this for a while. And so I don't necessarily think the date was anything special of the attack, but it certainly did indicate that Iran, at least internally, is somewhat vulnerable to attacks from the Islamic State, like many other nations are as well.
Well, we've talked about how Iran has used the Islamic State, in a sense, to serve its own purposes. If everybody's focused on attacking the Islamic State, it diverts attention away from dealing with Iran. How does this affect that calculus?
Well, I think there were two reasons why we said that Iran was benefiting a lot, really, from the Islamic State's rise. One is the one that you said, that it diverts attention from Iran's what they're actually doing across the Middle East. But the second reason was because the Iranians would be called on by the international community to actually aid in the fight against the Islamic State. And therefore, once the Islamic State's removed from these territories where Iran's forward army is moving, or their proxies, be it in Iraq or Syria, then Iran has power over those territories after the Islamic State is gone. Mm-hmm. What we're seeing with this attack, it seems, is the Islamic State finally recognizing, though they recognized this, I'm sure, earlier, they know that Iran is one of their great nemesis or enemies back in their fight against Syria. They're fighting against Hezbollah. They're fighting against the PMU, Iranian-backed Shiite militias. And now they've decided, well, we're actually going to fight against Iran itself. There was a special video that was released back in March by Islamic State's Iraq branch that called for direct attacks on Iran and the Iranian, the Shiite nation by the Sunnis inside Iran. And I think we might see some more of these attacks as the Islamic State recognizes even more so that Iran is being the one that benefits most from Islamic State's demise.
It really shows just the perversity in that whole line of thinking. If you have the Islamic State attacking Iran, presumably just not recognizing the legitimacy of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, that it's just a completely unsustainable ideology behind this. But we do appreciate that, Brent, especially you bringing up the fact that ISIS has nemesises. I think ISIS's nemesises needs to be, I don't know, the name of a rock band or something. Thanks for that. We reported recently on a spat between Germany and Turkey, where Germany said it would have to find another airbase to operate out of in the Middle East rather than the one in Turkey. It appears they've found that alternative. To learn about this, we'll go back to Britain and hear from Richard Palmer.
That's right. So on June 7th, Germany's cabinet agreed that they're going to move its main airbase for the Middle East from Incirlik in Turkey to the Azraq airbase in Jordan. The Incirlik base has been absolutely crucial to Germany's involvement in the fight against the Islamic, relatively small involvement, but involvement in the fight against the Islamic State. They have about 250 soldiers there. They have 6 aeroplanes that run reconnaissance operations. They run a refueling mission out of that airbase. It doesn't directly engage them in the fight. They're not physically attacking the Islamic State, but it has them in the area. It has them, you know, being used to operating with all the major players and just generally keeping a hand in the game. Now, relations broke down with Turkey. Going back almost a year now, Germany's parliament voted to say that Turkey's genocide of Armenians was a genocide. Turkey doesn't like their genocide being called a genocide, and so they got very cross with Germany's parliament. And now they've been refusing to let German parliamentarians visit their own soldiers in Incirlik. And that's kind of a big deal. You know, Germany was building up their own kind of section of the base. They had an agreement in place with Turkey to start building barracks and hangars and things that Germany would really control on this base. But then Turkey was refusing to let them in. So they had a few rounds of talks to try and resolve this. It got nowhere. And so finally this week they said, well, that's it. We're pulling out. We've had enough. And so within a couple of weeks, they said they're going to be back up and running, flying instead from Jordan.
So this suggests that there was quite a bit of dialogue in the relationship between Germany and Jordan for some time for this to happen so quickly. And why is it that we're so keen on seeing this relationship develop between Germany and Jordan?
Right. So going back to your first point, you're right. There has been a lot of dialogue between the two. There have been several million worth of grants. Germany, I think, has pledged something like $500 million to Jordan in terms of economic assistance, and it's doing things like building up its sanitation and its water. They're working together on all kinds of things, and they've been they've given, I think, Jordan over $1 billion since 2012 to help deal with the refugee crisis. So they do have a deeper relationship going backwards. But the main reason, or one of the main reasons we're watching this, is because just it ties directly into the prophesied configuration of nations that we're expecting to see within the Middle East. So Jordan is singled out very, very clearly in a couple of places as being basically aligned with this European power. They're mentioned, or at least the various different tribes that make up Jordan are mentioned in the Psalm 83 Alliance that gives a list of nations that are going to ally with Europe and with Germany. And then they're singled out again. Those three nations are singled out in Daniel 11 as not being invaded by this king of this European power when they move into the Middle East. That same passage lists several nations specifically that are invaded. Obviously, we know Iran as the king of the south is going to be invaded. It lists Egypt, Ethiopia, Libya. So these nations that passage implies are allied with Iran. But by singling out Jordan as one that doesn't get invaded, well, that implies very strongly that Jordan then is allied with Germany and with this European power. And so now we're seeing Germany's main airbase, admittedly small right now, but still the main point from which it might grow, moving from Turkey into Jordan. And so it'll be interesting to see. They've had a very strong economic relationship so far. Is this the beginning of a growing military relationship now?
Very good question. We appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard. We're going to go back to Asia. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization brings together China, Russia, and several other Eurasian nations into a political, economic, and military alliance. Two new members are about to be added. For this story, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the SCO, has been around for about two decades now, and it's dominated by China and also by Russia. And since its early years, the bloc has also included four of the STAN countries, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. And then on June 8th and 9th, they held their 17th summit. This took place in Kazakhstan, and they added two new and very notable members, India and Pakistan. So they got another powerful STAN on board, and also the world's second most populous country, India. So this enlargement really represents a major expansion in the population represented by the group. This means that almost half of all people on Earth are now represented by the SCO, and also about a quarter of total global GDP is now generated by SCO members. And it also just means that the geopolitical significance of this bloc is now pretty significantly expanded. And I think that one really interesting aspect of bringing India on board is just how it boosts Russia's power in the SCO relative to China's power within that grouping. We've long thought about the SCO as being mostly dominated and led by China. And militaristically and economically, China is the most powerful nation in the bloc. So that makes sense. But with India now in the group, that could really shift things in Russia's favor. India and Russia enjoy a really robust partnership. They cooperate across a wide range of issues. And now that India is an SCO member, Moscow and New Delhi are poised to overcome what has been probably the most serious obstacle in their bilateral trade, and that's just a lack of connectivity between the two nations. The two are expected to make some huge strides in the international north-south transport corridor, which they've been building with Iran over the last several years. And meanwhile, India and China have quite strained relations. Mm-hmm. They've got border disputes. They have disputes about China's Belt and Road Initiative, which India has actually been hindering parts of. So I just think this is really significant because Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has identified Russia and not China as the main power that will lead an end-time group of Asian nations. And we've often called attention to how the SCO could be one of the main vehicles that Russia uses to sort of wield the power of this group. And now with India in there, it's much easier to see how Russia could be calling more of those SCO shots and China could be calling fewer of them.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary. Just listening to you describe that, I think all of the language that you're using really resonates with anyone who's been familiar with what we've been teaching about that for a long time. If you're interested, go online to thetrumpet.com and download Russia and China in Prophecy, because it explains that the whole conglomeration of Asian nations that are prophesied to come together there. Certainly India is expected to be a major part of that. As you're saying, the way that this shifts the power into Russia's hands and brings all of them closer together, even you would expect a certain amount of allaying of the problems between India and China. That's a trend that we've watched for some time. It seems like this would send that forward as well. Very interesting. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. Well, to finish here, before we move on with our lightning round later, the World Economic Forum has made a very dire prediction. It says that by 2050, the world is going to face a $400 trillion shortfall in retirement savings. That's a lot of money. In fact, it's quite a bit more money than exists in the entire world. Quartz magazine called this the $400 trillion time bomb. To learn more about it, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Right. Well, we've reported on the show quite a few times before about how levels of consumer debt are at historic highs in America. Levels of personal savings are at historic lows in America. And now we've got around the world advances in medical science causing people to live a couple decades longer than they did in the near past, which all together with people, you're in debt, you're not savings, and you're living longer. This just all kind of binds together to make retirement a difficult part of life financially.
And the fact that governments over the same period that lifespans were increasing decided to get into the retirement savings game, which they weren't in that up until fairly recently.
Right. Just within since the 60s, it's really taken off that a lot of people are relying on the government to give you Social Security, and maybe we can get into that in a minute. But altogether, it's saying that even this year, there's an estimated $28 trillion deficit in personal retirement savings, or like the people currently working are $28 million cumulatively behind where they should be if they want to retire at 65.
Trillion or million? You said trillion?
Trillion.
Trillion dollars.
So it's, it's well, this for like all working, all the people in the workforce, like if they were to retire now, there would be $28 trillion that they don't have. And this is going to get worse over the years to where, as the pointed out here at the beginning, that globally, not just those sides of it, globally, by mid-century, there's going to be a $400 trillion deficit. And so this is going to be something, I mean, this is a huge problem that a lot of people, as you mentioned, are looking to the government to solve, to take care of them after they've retired, which is problematic too, is that obviously Social Security is, it's been likened to, in the United States, has been likened to a Ponzi scheme, in that it relies on three new working people to support everyone who's already retired. But as birth rates go down, they're saying that within a generation, just 25 years, instead of being three people supporting every retiree, it's going to be down to two people supporting every retiree, which means that by, I think, current estimates, it's about 2034, Social Security is going to be underfunded unless, like I said, the system's seriously overhauled or they do something, get some major population growth from somewhere. Bloomberg has reported that it's either we need to double the nation's fertility rate from like two children per average woman to four children per average woman almost immediately, or if that doesn't happen, it's going to take about 70 million immigrants over the next 20 years in order to keep the workforce big enough to actually keep Social Security solvent.
It's absolutely insane. We're going to have to find some other way to fund our retirement if we expect to have one, I suppose.
Right. At this point, it would be wise to just assume that you're on your own and try to do whatever you can to make that work.
Well, thank you for that very sunshiny news, Andrew. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. Visit us online at thetrumpet.com. We've got a lot of stories on there, a lot of those that we talked about today we've written up and put on the website. We're going to finish the program with our lightning round of important news. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time for our lightning round. We'll take one last look at some headlines that caught our attention from this past week, and we'll start with Richard.
On Wednesday, the European Commission published a paper trying to kickstart some more discussions about having a European military. They laid out three scenarios that they wanted as a basis for negotiation. The European Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker, has been kind of doing the rounds, and Donald Trump's visit a couple of weeks ago to Europe has really kickstarted these negotiations. In the past, Europe has been reluctant to move towards a European military, or some powers have, because they see it as doubling up with NATO. But after Donald Trump's comments on NATO, it's given these discussions some renewed seriousness.
All right, over to Brent.
Saleh Al-Haruri, he's a senior commander who was recently deported from Qatar, has moved, naturally, to Lebanon, and he intends to launch terror attacks from there to Israel. That's what Defense Minister of Israel Avigdor Lieberman told Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador, this week. Lieberman continued to say that Hamas will continue to try to perpetrate terror attacks against Israel from Lebanon, while at the same time strengthening their ties between Hamas and Hezbollah. And all of this will be done under the Iranian auspices with aid from the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps Commander Qassem Soleimani. Now, if that quote could have come from an article we wrote last week about Hamas's growing relationship with Iran. If you want to go back and read that, it's entitled Iran and Hamas Are Back Together.
All right, over to Andrew.
Viruses, violent conflicts, and a host of other regional calamities are reviving people's desire to move to another country. According to a recent Gallup poll, approximately 14% of the world's adults, 710 million people, wish to become immigrants. And while the United States continues to be the most desired destination for potential immigrants, the number who say they'd actually prefer Germany has risen from 28 million to 39 million.
And Jeremiah.
On Friday, South Korea's military announced that they had found a quite advanced North Korean drone equipped with a camera on a mountain near its border with North Korea. So it looks like this device was on a spying mission of some kind. There are few details available right now, but it looks like another strong indication of just how quickly North Korea's military and espionage technology is advancing.
All right, we'll go back to Richard.
Germany is, quote, the new moral superpower. This is what the Spiegel magazine proclaimed in the wake of Donald Trump pulling out of the climate change agreement. It says that Germany has now fulfilled its, quote, historic mission to, quote, be the lead nation of the world. It's just a dramatic example now of how Germany is starting to really see itself as the leader of the free world and, in many ways, America's replacement.
And back to Brent.
U.S.-backed Syrian forces announced this week that they've begun the long-awaited offensive to capture Raqqa, the headquarters of the Islamic State. A spokesperson for the Kurdish-dominated Syrian Democratic Forces told reporters on Tuesday that their operations for Raqqa began in coordination with the international coalition. Now, this fight for Raqqa will largely determine who is going to control most of eastern Syria. This is an extremely important region right now as both Iran and Sunni forces battle to control these crossroads. And for more on that, you can look forward to Callum Wood's article coming up next week entitled, working title, Iranian Militias Reach the Syrian Border.
Okay, we'll go back to Andrew.
If you're an avid sky watcher, you may have noticed a conspicuous lack of sunspots recently. NASA recently posted a new image of the sun taken last month that shows no obvious sunspots. And since sunspots are disturbances in the sun's atmosphere that appear dark because they're colder than the surrounding areas, they're actually associated with an increase in solar activity. This lack of sunspots indicates that we're currently headed into an era of less solar activity than the past. And the head of the Pulkovo Observatory in Russia warns that this may be a sign that global cooling will kick in within the next couple decades.
All right, we'll go back to Richard.
The prime ministers or the leaders of India and China have both been visiting Europe and have been meeting with German leaders. They've been working on trade. And again, this came in the wake of that dramatic visit by Donald Trump. It's been an interesting, you know, there's been a lot of talk about a trade alliance between Europe and the East because of these agreements. At the same time, there's been a lot of friction as they kind of vie for who's going to be top dog in this trade relationship. And so that whole situation, the negotiations, and that even that competition is going to be something interesting to watch going forwards.
All right, we'll finish with Jeremiah.
Chinese workers are apparently keen on capturing some of that spotless sunshine that Andrew is talking about. This week, they switched on the world's largest floating solar farm. It's an astounding number of panels which are floating on a man-made lake in China's Anhui province, and it can produce about 40 megawatts of power, which is enough to power more than 15,000 homes. And the project's engineers say that one big advantage of building solar plants on top of lakes is that the water cools the electronics in the panels, which allows them to function much more efficiently.
Well, that's pretty cool. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. I'd like to encourage you to visit thetrumpet.com to read the stories that we talked about on the program today. You can also give us your feedback by emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to the panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
You're welcome.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Elbert Hubbard: to know when to be generous and when firm, that is wisdom. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.